Welcome to DeltaCast, the podcast about the science of learning and development. My name is Eric Jackson. I'm here, as always, with co-host Mark Blumberg.
Hi, Eric.
And joining us today is the founding director of the Early Cognitive Development Center at the University of Queensland, Dr. Virginia Slaughter. Thanks so much for being with us today, Dr. Slaughter.
Good morning.
Your team recently published a paper on neonatal imitation in current biology, and it's been garnering some attention, so we'd like to talk about it. But before we do that, I was hoping that you could tell us what neonatal imitation is and why it's important to study.
Neonatal imitation is a capacity for newborn babies to copy gestures that they see other people doing. And there's been controversy about whether such capacity exists since the late 70s. So prior to that, the classical theories of imitation suggested that babies wouldn't be able to copy other people's gestures, particularly facial gestures, until about month 8 or 9. But then paper was published in Science in 1977 claiming that babies, within a few hours after birth, could copy tongue poking, mouth opening, and hand gestures.
So this was a big deal because it seemed to fly in the face of Piaget's ideas about imitation, right?
Well, there were lots of implications for it. The original implications that were made much of was that it suggested that babies had a capacity to mentally represent because they were able to draw on a representation that was matching what they saw and what they were doing with their own bodies. Subsequently, over the next couple of decades, a number of theories were built on the belief that this capacity was there. And these are actually quite rich and compelling theories. So, for instance, the idea that babies are born with this representation, and it's a representation of being human in a sense. And so you can, from the time of birth, see that babies are connecting with other people and sharing not only their gestures but potentially their experiences as well.
So a lot in psychological theory was riding, in a sense, on this being a real phenomenon.
Yeah, it came to be that way. And then the discovery of mirror neurons about 15 years ago just added fuel to this, because here was a potential neurological mechanism.
I just want to read one sentence from the paper. Given the methodological strengths of the current study compared to previous studies, our results suggest that the many prominent theories built upon the assumption of neonatal imitation are not empirically supported and should be modified or abandoned altogether. So that's a pretty controversial sentence.
It is.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, that sentence refers to a long history of controversy about neonatal imitation. It's not just that we came in and said, oh, look, we didn't find it, so everybody give up now. We're in a tradition of researchers who have attempted to replicate the phenomenon of neonatal imitation and failed to do so. So if you look back at the history, I mentioned that first paper published in Science 1977 by Meltzoff and Moore claimed to demonstrate that newborns could imitate. And then following that, into the 80s, there were replications and there were non-replications, and both were being published. So even early on, there was still quite a lot of questioning about the basic phenomenon.
So if you go back to that period of time, so there was Moshe Annisfeld was one person who prominently was arguing that the tongue protrusion phenomenon, that is the ability of babies to stick out their tongue when they see somebody else sticking out their tongue, that was the phenomenon that replicated the most. And Susan Jones followed that up with her own studies and over decades of work, really, saying many of the same things. From their perspective, I guess, if you talk to them, I mean, I know Susan Jones, and she would argue that this phenomenon has been unsupportable or unsupported for decades. Why does it continue to be such a big controversy? Why have those failures to replicate, or in many respects, they replicated certain aspects of the finding, but they gave a less, let's say, a sexy explanation for it than the Meltzoff and Moore explanation. So why didn't it have more traction? What was it about the Meltzoff and Moore explanation that seemed to be so resistant to these negative views?
Good question. I think a few things are happening. One is Meltzoff and Moore's finding just really captured people's interest. It was a time when there was a shift, I think, towards nativist views of humans. And so the idea that newborns were equipped with a mechanism that immediately created social connection with other people was a compelling one, and one that fit into the way people were starting to think about newborns.
Essentially, they were hardwired.
Yes, and they were hardwired with a mechanism that had evolutionary significance. So their capacity to imitate connected them with other people, created rapport, and therefore led to caregivers investing in them, thereby ensuring their survival. I think another thing is that over time, if you look at the publications about neonatal imitation, early on there were non-replications, just straight non-replications, we couldn't find it type studies being published, and then those just simply dropped out over the course of about 15 years after the first paper came out. So, you know, that just means, I think, that people who attempted to find the phenomenon and couldn't either said, well, I'm never going to be able to publish this because it's just a null result, or even tried to publish it and couldn't find an outlet for it.
So let's go back to the original phenomenon, because it is an extraordinary thing to even think that a child, a baby, can come out of the womb and upon its first visual experience with light in the world, at least imaged light in the world, could look at a mouth and see a tongue come out and link that visual stimulus to its own motor system connected to its own tongue and stick it out in a way that matches what it saw with its visual system. That's a pretty amazing thing to think that a baby could do. I mean, it's not hard to see why it would capture someone's attention, but Susan Jones and others, I'm sure, have talked about this correspondence problem, as it's called, as something that is too much to think that a child, a newborn infant, would be able to do. So how does that get put into the whole picture here?
So how does tongue protrusion
tongue protrusion or anything else? I mean, how does the fact that a newborn infant with no experience linking its visual and its motor system up upon its first experience manages to solve that problem? That's an extraordinary thing to think would be hardwired in the system of a newborn.
It sounds kind
of
crazy.
It sounds crazy.
Yeah.
Doesn't it? Do you think it does?
I think we get used to these ideas. it's funny you say that, because one of my postdocs has been gathering comments from the general public on, in response to the media reports of our paper, and they're really informative. Most of them are saying, gee, what a waste of taxpayer money. Who in their right mind would ever think that newborn babies could imitate? That's absolutely ridiculous. Have these people never seen a newborn in their life? So yeah, it is. I guess if you step back, it does seem incredible, but as I say, I think it was I think it was part of a general trend toward toward searching for innate capacities in humans.
So when you started your project, which was some years ago, because you even wrote a paper about this paper, right? I mean, you wrote a paper about doing longitudinal work and following babies over time. So this mm-hmm. was, you've been planning this for, I imagine, many years now.
Many years.
So you yeah. knew that the approach that you were taking, which was to study the same babies over many weeks, was going to be informative. Why did you decide to commit so much time and resources to a project like this? It's an extraordinary undertaking.
Well, the truth is that we came at this project from the perspective that probably there was neonatal imitation of some form, if not the capacity to flexibly imitate lots of different gestures, potentially at least the capacity to imitate tongue protrusion, which, as you mentioned, is the one that's been best replicated in the literature. And our idea was to test Meltzoff's sort of the big theory, which is that this capacity is foundational for social development. And so our longitudinal study, it actually had several different aims. One was just to establish the extent to which neonatal imitation exists and how reliable it is, because the vast majority of studies only test babies on one or two gestures, such as tongue protrusion and mouth opening, and they only test them on one occasion. And so we wanted to do a longitudinal study partly to establish reliability of it. And then we had long-term follow-ups looking at other elements of social development with the view that if there is this capacity and it is foundational for subsequent social development, then individual differences that we observe in a large sample of newborn babies should have ramifications for later aspects of social development. So we set out thinking that we would find imitation in newborns, and then were honestly kind of chagrined to not find anything at all.
I'm curious, have you heard anything from Meltzoff about this paper?
We have heard from a group of researchers who have built their careers on neonatal imitation, both in humans and in non-human primates, led by Pierre Ferrari. Meltzoff is a member of this group, and they wrote to us to say that, very politely, that that they felt that there were some flaws in our study, and that they'd like to address them in the literature. And so currently, I understand they're preparing a critical commentary, which they're going to submit for publication with the idea that we would then respond.
So let me ask you this question. You've now done this. You say you were chagrined. In the paper, twice, I believe, you say surprisingly, right? Something that caught my eye. I mean, so you were being honest about that when you say surprisingly. Clearly. So you were surprised by what it was. Where do you fall? So if you were laying bets, do you believe that neonatal imitation exists, or that it has been a bit of an illusion that was built up over the years?
I think it's an illusion, but I think it's an easy one to fall prey to, because I think what happens is that newborns are very attuned to other people and their faces in particular. And so in a face-to-face context, like we use when testing neonatal imitation, babies do get quite aroused. And this is Susan Jones's argument. They get quite aroused, and they do a lot of things, including a lot of tongue protrusion. So she's actually got other studies showing that in addition to a human face making gestures, other arousing stimuli such as music will will increase newborns' tendency to poke out their tongue. And I think because as adults, we are so we're so prone to connecting with babies, anthropomorphizing them, seeing meaning in what they do, that we see this behavior increase and we interpret it as communicative.
So the point being here is that the reason that babies were sticking out their tongues had nothing to do with the fact that somebody in front of them was sticking out their tongue. It's just something that they like to do in response to any kind of stimuli.
Well, that's Susan's perspective. Yeah, that there, it's a number of things could cause them to poke out their tongue. And in fact, that's what our data show as well. Moving faces, it seems, in our data caused them to poke out their tongue. So we got equal numbers of tongue protrusion when babies were presented with tongue protrusion or mouth opening or a happy facial expression or a sad facial expression. All of those things got them excited and increased their rates of tongue protrusion.
So in a weird way, Andy Meltzoff in that original paper, I mean, it's a weird way to look at it, but because babies are sticking out their tongue so often, the experimenters were actually imitating the baby and not the baby imitating the experimenters.
I wouldn't go that far because if you read their methodology, they were very strict in their presentation of tongue protrusion. So they stick out their tongue every 3 seconds.
Oh, what I mean is what I mean. Seconds. Oh, I'm sorry. What I meant was that. No, you're right in terms of the methodology. But what I meant was that focusing on tongue protrusion, it's what babies did a lot. And so naturally that led them to think, oh, maybe if I stick out my tongue, they'll do it too. So it was the time scale of imitation for the adults was on a longer loop. But that's just an aside. Go ahead.
That is a good point, though, because I think that potentially what tongue protrusion is a very noticeable act. And I'm sort of been toying with the idea that we do imitate our babies, and tongue protrusion is one of the things that's quite noticeable and easy for us to imitate. So we get in face-to-face interactions with our newborns. We love them. We want to play with them. We want to connect with them. They get excited. They stick out their tongue. We stick out our tongue imitating them, and then that reinforces the behavior that they're doing at the time, which is tongue protrusion, and soon you're in a loop whereby the babies are being reinforced for the behavior that you're imitating, but it looks like they're imitating. And then down the track, they imitate because they have been they've basically been trained into this sort of an exchange. And so we're gonna work on some training studies now to see if we can actually, you know, make this happen through an experiment rather than just guessing that it's what's going on.
What about the argument that neonatal imitation does exist, but infants just don't have the capacity yet to carry out whatever the motor act that they're seeing is?
Well, these behaviors are all in their repertoires. And so you're saying that they just can't harness the control of the behaviors to do it in response to the matching gesture by the adult? Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm questioning.
I think in this case we would have increase in matching behavior over the course of our experiment, but we don't have much evidence for that. If you look at tongue protrusion by our final testing period, which is at week 9, we do see more selective tongue protrusion responses than anything else. So they stick out their tongue pretty much mostly to the tongue protrusion gesture, and I'm trying to remember what the other ones are. But Yeah, so I'm just looking at my data here. So by 9 weeks, baby's tongue protrusion is equal to both tongue protrusion and to happy face only, which kind of potentially suggests that it's starting to become selective. But we don't see that in any of the other gestures, which are equally in the baby's repertoires, like mouth opening and hand grasping and making happy and sad faces.
Right, which is really interesting about the paper is that, in effect, you do replicate the earlier studies, but when you put it in the broader context of using a variety of different models and you study them longitudinally, you find out that there just is no foundation for concluding that this is actually based on imitation.
Yes.
So I have sort of a meta question for you then. You mentioned other people who have built their careers on the 1977 finding, which it's extraordinary. That's 39 years ago. And here we are still. You know, most scientific problems like this are resolved much more quickly. And that could suggest that there's something special about these sorts of problems working with infants. It could suggest lots of things, developmental general, psychology, you know, you name it. But my question is so, you know, Andy Meltzoff has had a huge amount of, he's built a lot of his ideas around this finding. Students have built their careers around this finding. What is the appropriate response? When does a scientist need to take a step back and look at it, or can they take a step back and look at the phenomenon without the rose-colored glasses, without the ego, and without all of the things that go along with it? I mean, it's a hard thing to do, right? So what would be your response? What would you do if you were in Andy Meltzoff's shoes, faced with this really, really prominent challenge to one of your seminal findings?
Honestly, I'd probably do what they're doing, which is go through the paper line by line and see if I can find a problem with it.
And is that the most honorable thing to do, or is that just the human thing to do?
Well, I think it's human, and I do think it's part of the scientific process. You know, everybody does their studies slightly differently. We've got more gestures. We've got longitudinal. Actually, our coding scheme is built on what people have previously done. But still, I think it's natural and not at all dishonorable to say, well, is there something in the methodology that's led to a different result from the one that I've come to believe is the correct one? I think, you know, if you feel that you've seen this phenomenon repeatedly, then you would say, well, how come you can't find it? And I think that's what their reaction is. Honestly, that was our first reaction. our first response when these data finally came through and we ran the whole longitudinal analysis was, oh my God, what's going on? We don't even have tongue protrusion. So we went back and we did some extra coding. We tried this. We tried that. Are there some babies that maybe are in the wrong state? Maybe we've been too harsh with our coding scheme. We tried a bunch of different things just to see if there was something that we were obviously doing that was leading to the result that we got. And there just wasn't. No matter how you slice it, the data are the data that we've collected. And so we said, well, this is the way it is. So much for all that longitudinal testing that we've done. because if there's no neonatal imitation, there's nothing to correlate with later social developments. So, all right, well, we just go with the truth and write it up and publish it in the best journal we can find.
Well, you did a good job on that front. But what boggles my mind, I guess, a little bit is that, as you point out in the paper, this finding has been the foundation for many claims about modules in the brain that are specifically involved with this innate ability to imitate, with all kinds of social cognition theories, with theory of mind, with autism, with you know, you name it. I mean, it's been associated with everything. Shouldn't something that is that foundational simply pop out, be easily replicable, be you know, show itself in all of its magnitude without all of this tweaking and looking and finding and controversy? Doesn't the mere fact that there's a controversy undermine the idea that this is an important foundational feature of human social cognition?
Yes, I agree with you.
Okay.
If the claim is that it's an evolved mechanism that immediately creates a connection between the just-born baby and its caregivers, then, yeah, it should be pretty robust. If it's going to do the job that it's claimed to do, then you shouldn't have to gesture for 40 seconds or have a bright light shining on the face or, do any of the other things that we know our detractors are going to be saying weren't in our study and therefore led to our negative result. You can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't say this is a robust phenomenon and it's the foundation of all social development and it's built into the human brain, but you can only see it if you do it like this at this particular time in this particular way.
Great point.
Going back to your point about how other people have come up with the same finding or similar findings, do you think part of the problem is just the fact that journals are not interested in either replication or no results?
Yeah, definitely.
The file drawer effect.
I meant to say no results, no results.
So is that what happened? Is that with the people who were coming up to you were saying that we tried to replicate, failed, and dropped the project?
Dropped the project or couldn't get it published?
Yeah.
I've heard both.
Well, there was just that. There was just that. There was a meeting at the International Conference on Infant Studies, a pre-conference discussion of best practices, where they were trying to talk about the need to publish these failures to replicate because they're recognizing. Just what you're recognizing is until you have these sorts of prominent studies that what's extraordinary about your paper is that it is basically a null finding in a sense. And to be published in such a prominent place right. and to have a failure. It's much more than that. Of course, it's a very rich data set, but it's these sorts of things don't get published very often. And then folks don't talk about it until they see, evidence that there have been these failures to replicate by other people. So it's a big problem for our field.
Mm. Yeah, honestly, I think that what saves our study is that if you pull out the cross-sectional data, if you pull out the data from week one and you just compare mouth opening and tongue protrusion, which is what the vast majority of studies have done for the last 20 years to supposedly establish the phenomenon, you get the same result that other people get, more tongue poking in response to tongue poking as opposed to mouth opening. It's just when you broaden it out to all the other gestures and to four different time points that just pales. It just,
Exactly.
But you don't call that imitation because it doesn't last and it doesn't extend beyond the comparison to mouth opening.
Well, it was a beautiful piece of work, a great paper, and it's really been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate that you're so frank in talking about this this whole process, because I think in many respects what happened with your paper is it's not specific just to the imitation problem. There are many other areas of science, psychology, developmental psychology that face many of these same problems. But so I think it's a good lesson for other domains.
It is, and I hope that I get the sense that maybe we're moving towards a time when pre-registration of really large-scale studies like this will start to be more common, so that if it is an important question, then we say what we're going to do, we get the go-ahead to do it, and then we accept the results come what may. I think that'll give us a much clearer picture of what newborns and babies and children really can do.
Fantastic. Great way to end.
Yeah, thank you so much again for joining us, Virginia, and thanks for listening to DeltaCast, everybody.
Thank you.
See you
Bye.
Next time.
Good night. Good morning.
DeltaCast is the official podcast of the Delta Center at the University of Iowa and is co-produced by Eric Jackson, Mark Blumberg, and Jessica Hall. The Delta Center is supported by the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences, the Department of Communication Sciences and Disorders, the College of Education, the Office of the Vice President for Research, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Obermann Center. All of the music you heard during today's podcast was written by my good friend Josh Kaufman. Thank you, Josh. You can learn more about the Delta Center by going to www.deltacenter.uiowa.edu, and you can also follow us on Facebook.